Hello everyone, and welcome back to the history of Scotland. I'm Fraser, and as always, it's a pleasure to deep dive into the annals of Scottish history with all of you. In our last episode, we journeyed through the reign of the capable and influential Alexander I, a king whose contributions set the stage for many of the transformations Scotland would witness in the subsequent decades. Now, you might be wondering, having delved into Alexander I's reign, wouldn't the logical step be to transition directly to his brother, David I? Ordinarily, yes, and fear not, we will soon turn our attention to David, a monarch I'm particularly eager to discuss, and obviously one of my favourites, as I've alluded to many times now. However, before we forge ahead, there's a chapter of Scottish history that, while we've touched upon in previous episodes, it merits its own spotlight, similar to how we did this for the history of the Normans, this being the era of Scandinavian Scotland. From the early Viking incursions up to the time of David I, Scotland's story is intricately intertwined with that of the Norsemen. For listeners who have been with us from the beginning, you'll recall that we spent a significant portion of episodes 4 through to 22 discussing the Vikings' role in Scottish history, popping in and out of our story. Think of the Macbeth episodes. Yet, considering the profound impact the Scandinavians had on shaping Scotland, I felt it necessary to dedicate an episode solely to them, drawing parallels and contrasts, much like our own special episode on the history of Normans, like I mentioned. Now, to truly appreciate the intricacies of Scandinavian Scotland, let's turn back the pages of time. Cast your mind back to around the 5th episode when we first introduced the fierce and fearless Vikings who began to appear on the horizons of Britain. These seafaring warriors, hailing from the lands we now identify as Norway, Denmark and Sweden, embarked on expeditions that would take them across vast seas, leading them to the rugged and mysterious shores of Scotland and England. Their reasons for venturing into the unknown territories were varied, spanning from the lore of uncharted lands, trade prospects, political strife in their homeland, and sheer adventure. The Vikings' connection with Scotland wasn't just one of raiding and conquering, it was also about settlement, culture amalgamation, and the ensuring relationships both harmonious and contentious with the indigenous populations. In this episode, we're going to delve deep into the captivating saga of the Vikings and Scandinavians in Scotland, explore their initial incursions, understand where they settled, identify the kingdoms that stood resiliently against them, and spotlight the earliest Scandinavian leaders who set foot on Scottish soil. So, hold tight as we embark on this voyage, retracing the footsteps of the Norsemen and unearthing the tales of Scandinavian Scotland that have been etched into the very fabric of this great land. In the historical tapestry of Scotland, the threads of Viking incursions shimmer with both dread and fascination. To appreciate the depth of this narrative, we must venture to the distant lands of Scandinavia itself, understanding the origins, culture, and motivations of these formidable Norsemen before tracing their journey to Scotland. The term Viking is derived from the Old Norse word vikingar, signifying a pirate or raider. Hailing primarily from the modern-day countries of Norway, Denmark and Sweden, these seafarers occupied a region characterised by vast fjords, dense forests and a challenging climate. These harsh terrains shaped them into skilled sailors, explorers and tenacious warriors. Now, Scandinavian society was a complex blend of familial clans and tribes. While their lands had kings, local chieftains or jarls, they held significant sway, but central to their way of life was a concept of honour. Personal reputation and family legacy was paramount, often leading to feuds and vendettas that spanned generations. This clannish structure, interspread with frequent infighting, inadvertently honed their combat skills. Their spiritual realm, rooted in Norse mythology, which could be its entire own podcast, consisted of the pantheon led by the gods such as Odin, Thor, Freya. These deities, often linked to war, bravery and honour, further solidified their martial ethos. Rituals, sacrifices and the promise of Valhalla, a glorious afterlife for fallen warriors, cemented their audacity in the face of death. Now, several factors spurred the Viking exodus from their homeland. Overpopulation coupled with limited arable land made resources crucial. Moreover, internal power struggles and ambitions of chieftains yearning for their own territories added fuel to this migratory fire. The Vikings' initial ventures were raid-based, seeking quick plunder, but soon a combination of opportunity, evolving strategy, and the allure of richer lands transformed these raiders into campaigns of conquest and colonization. Now, how did they actually get across the sea? The sea between Britain and the Nordic countries is quite a rough sea, even for today's ships. So now, let's touch upon their famous longship. The iconic Viking longship was central to their expeditions. With its sleek, clinker-built design, shallow draft, and symmetrical bow and stern, it was an engineering marvel of its age. Its design allowed for both speed in open waters and the ability to navigate shallow rivers, facilitating rapid inland incursions. Decorated with intricate carvings and sometimes a fearsome dragonhead prow, these ships were both functional and symbolic of Viking power. The combination of their shipbuilding expertise and adept navigational skills, possibly using sun compasses and understanding of sea landmarks, made the Vikings unparalleled seafarers of their era. Now, something that happened most of the time when they found land is their attack and raiding. And how did no one stop them? Surely these raiders who just had axes and bare chests could easily be taken out. Well, their prowess in battle is legendary. The Vikings capitalized on shock tactics, rapid mobilization from their ships, and psychological warfare. Their war cries and appearance often struck terror into their foes. Their weaponry, comprising of axes, swords, spears, and the iconic round shield, helped them take on any foes that met them as they came off their ships, and they were easily squashed. Their combat style was aggressive and direct, relying on swift melee engagements. Now, when did the Vikings discover Britain? The question of when takes us back to a specific fateful day in 793 AD, when the Vikings, according to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, launched a brutal raid on the monastery at Lindisfarne on the northeast coast of England. This attack, just south of the Scottish border, was a precursor to the Norse expansion into Scotland. By the end of the 8th century and the beginning of the 9th century, the Vikings had turned their sights on Scotland's inviting shores. Hailing primarily from the rugged landscapes of Norway, Denmark, and Sweden, these Nordic navigators were driven by a mix of overpopulation, internal power struggles, and an unstable thirst for exploration. These factors, combined with their advanced seafaring capabilities, motivated them to journey west, reaching the British Isles, and specifically Scotland. Upon arrival, the Vikings initially targeted monastic settlements, which were richly endowed and poorly defended. Places like Iona, an epic centre of Christian learning, faced repeated Viking raids. You'll remember Iona as being a place for the early kings of Alba, who would be buried there when they would pass away, and they were buried at Iona as a central place for Christian burials for the kingdom. But their intentions were not purely about raiding, they were also looking for places to settle. The Scottish terrain, with its fjord-like sea locks and islands, must have felt somewhat familiar to these Norse settlers. The northern isles of Orkney and Shetland quickly became key Viking strongholds. These islands offered a strategic vantage point for further raids and explorations, and over time, Norse influence over them was so profound that they remained under Norwegian rule until the late 15th century. But that is obviously for a later episode. Now, beyond the Northern Isles, the Hebrides were another prime target for Viking expansion. Known as the Southern Isles, these isles became a patchwork of Norse and Gaelic influence, both culturally and politically. By the mid-9th century, Norse settlers began intermingling with the local Gaels, leading to a unique hybrid culture known as the Foreign Gaels. The Vikings didn't just limit their incursions to the islands, however. The mainland too saw its fair share of Norse footsteps. Coastal regions, particularly along the west, felt the Viking presence. Places like Caverness, Sutherland, and the western seaboard down to Kenai saw Norse settlements. These territories were often interspread with areas of Gaelic or Pictish control, leading to a mosaic of cultural and political entities. But the Vikings didn't go unchallenged. The patchwork of kingdoms that made up early medieval Scotland, like our most famous Kingdom of the Picts in the north and east, the Scots of Del Rida in the west, and the Britons of Strathclyde in the southwest, often found themselves in conflict with these new settlers. And that's something we covered earlier on in our episodes, around episodes 9, 10 and 11. The Picts, particularly under the leaders like Bride MacFergus, resisted Viking advancements fiercely. As for the early Viking leaders who made their mark on Scotland, names like Ketel Flatnose come to mind. Ketel was a Norse king from the 9th century who, according to the sagas, established a dynasty in the Hebrides. The Orkney saga also gives accounts of Norse earls of Orkney, like Ragnarvald Estensson and his son Turf Einar, who were instrumental in establishing Norse rule in the Northern Isles. The Viking arrival in Scotland was more than just a series of raids and invasions. It was a complex interplay of conquest, settlement, resistance, and assimilation. The Norse influence would weave its way into the fabric of Scotland, laying the foundation for the centuries of shared history, culture, and lineage. The story of Scotland, replete with the tales of valour, intrigue, and shifting alliances, gains further complexity when viewed through the lens of its relationship with the Scandinavian settlers. A paramount chapter in this narrative revolves around the Kingdom of Alba, our most famous kingdom before it became the Kingdom of Scotland, and its interactions with the Norsemen. Established around the mid-9th century as we know, the Kingdom of Alba emerged as the prominent Gaelic kingdom in the area of Scotland. Its foundation coincided with the era when the Norse settlements in Scotland were growing in strength and influence. This timing set the stage for inevitable encounters between Alba and the Norse communities. Initially, their interactions were largely confrontational. Think of Macbeth and the Norse raids around the Northern Isles. The Norsemen raids on monastic communities and their incursions into territories claimed by Alba led to numerous skirmishes. But as time passed, a realisation of mutual benefits prompted periods of uneasy peace punctured by strategic alliances. Marriages between Norse and Scottish nobility further blurred the line between friend and foe. But even in these peaceful interludes, the underlying tensions were still there. Beyond the physical skirmishes, there existed a deep-rooted culture tug of war. The Norse settlers, especially in the northern and western isles, continued practicing their traditions from the distant ship burials to their runic inscriptions. Yet the underlying Gaelic culture was resilient. Over generations, a fascinating fusion began to take shape, best exemplified in the Norse Gaelic Kingdom of the Isles. Here, Norse jarls often bore Gaelic titles, and vice versa. Gaelic and Norse languages intermingled, leading to hybrid dialects. Art, especially stone carvings and metalwork, displayed a blend of both cultural motifs. This amalgamation wasn't just a matter of convenience, it was a testament to the adaptability of both civilizations. Now, Orkney was a strategic archipelago, was used as one of the main Viking strongholds in the early medieval time. It had immense importance to the Norse. Its proximity to both Norway and the Scottish mainland made it a valuable asset for control, trade, and as a launching point for further expeditions. The Norse grip on Orkney was solidified by a series of strong leaders who established a dynasty. These Norse earls built formidable strongholds, the most famous being the Brook of Gurness. Through adept maritime skills, trade networks, and a system of fealties, they ensured Orkney remained a Norse bastion for centuries. Now the question arises, why didn't the Kingdom of Alba expel the Norse invaders as the Anglo-Saxons attempted further south? Several factors come into play for this reason. One of which is the geographical complexity. Scotland's rugged terrain, peppered with islands, fjords, and highlands, made unified resistance challenging. This landscape was both a bane and a boon, offering hideouts for the Scots, but also giving the Norse, with their naval prowess, several advantages. Also, Scotland wasn't a single entity at this time, remember? It was a patchwork of kingdoms and tribes. While Alba was influential, consolidated a united front against the Norse was logistically and politically difficult. The lines between foes and allies were often blurred. Intermarriages and treaties meant at times it was more beneficial for Alba to collaborate with the Norse lords rather than confront them. Now, the Norse era witnessed several luminous figures who left an indelible mark on Scotland. Among the notable of these Scandinavian leaders were Rögnvald Estensson, often credited as a founder of the Earldom of Orkney. He played a pivotal role in establishing Norse dominance in the Northern Isles. Sigurd the Mighty. As Rögnvald's brother and successor, Sigurd expanded Norse territories and influence, although his ambitious campaigns often bordered on the audacious. Thorfinn Skullsplitter. I love that name. His fierce name is a testament to his reputation. Thorfinn's rule saw the Orkneys become a significant power centre in the Norse world. These leaders, each with their unique style and vision, reinforced a Norse foothold in Scotland, ensuring their legacy would intertwine with Scotland's history for generations. The vast canvas of Scottish history and Norse sagas intertwine in a dance of power, influence, and culture. The imprint of Scandinavians in Scotland is evidently not only in the lands they held, but also in the impact they had on early Scottish monarchies, notable figures like Macbeth and the lasting legacy in the Orkney Islands. Now, we know the tale of Macbeth, we know the immortalised story by Shakespeare, and it's deeply rooted in historical events, and the Norse connection forms a crucial subplot. Macbeth's ascension to the throne in 1040 was during an era of considerable Norse influence. His wife, Ruach, was of royal lineage, which strengthened his claim. But less known is her lineage had Norse connections, tracing back to a Norse Gaelic blend from previous intermarriages between Norse settlers and Gaelic nobility. Moreover, the political landscape of Scotland during Macbeth's rule was heavily affected by the Norse military campaigns, especially those emanating from Orkney. To fortify his rule, Macbeth may have forged alliances with Norse leaders, possibly even marrying into Norse aristocracy, as was common for these strategic purposes. But if we just cast our mind back to Orkney itself, the Norse Earldom of Orkney, as we know, was established around the 9th century, and it lasted until the late 15th century. The Orkney's strategic importance as a maritime hub, coupled with the fertile lands, made it attractive for all the Norse settlers. Throughout the reigns of several Scottish kings leading up to David I, the Norse grip on Orkney remained steadfast. The islands operated somewhat autonomously with their own Norse earls, often with dual fealties to the Norwegian crown, and occasionally, as circumstances demanded, to the Scottish king. By David I's reign, the cultural amalgamation in Orkneys was profound. Norse traditions blended seamlessly with the Gaelic customs. Norse language, Old Norse, fused with the Old Gaelic, giving birth to the Norn language, which was spoken in Orkneys until the 18th century. By the time of David I, the Norse influence in Scotland was not just confined to the Northern Isles, Orkney and Shetland. They also held significant territories in the Western Isles, including the Hebrides, parts of Caithness and Sutherland on the mainland, and it had established settlements along the western coast, including Galloway. Alexander I, like his predecessors, had a nuanced relationship with the Norse, however. While there were sporadic hostilities, Alexander recognised the strategic importance of maintaining diplomatic ties with the Norse earls. This pragmatic approach, a blend of diplomacy and deterrence, often ensured that large-scale conflicts were averted. Earlier kings like Malcolm II often had to defend against Norse incursions, especially from the leaders seeking to expand their territories from the established bases in Orkney or the Hebrides. But as history marched on, diplomacy began to play a more significant role, with the intermarriages and the treaties becoming common tools of statecraft. Alexander I's reign saw both confrontations and collaborations. While records of any major wars between Alexander I and the Norse are sparse, the geopolitical landscape suggests that skirmishes and minor conflicts would have been inevitable. Yet, the very continuity of the Norse settlements and the relative stability of the period indicate that outright hostilities were likely limited, replaced by negotiations and the strategic alliances Alexander brought to the table. But by David I's time, the broad Norse realm was undergoing transformation. The centralization of power in Norway meant that the Norwegian king sought tighter control over the Norse territories in Scotland. This culminated in the Treaty of Perth in 1266 AD, where Norway ceded the Hebrides and the Isle of Man to Scotland. While this is post-David I, it signifies a trajectory during his reign, a gradual assimilation of Norse territories into the burgeoning Scottish kingdom. David I's reign is also notable for the Davidonian Revolution, where he introduced sweeping reforms and brought Scotland closer to the European norms. Now, we are going to go on about the Davidonian Revolution in our later episodes, an entire episode actually dedicated to him on the revolution. But the Norse, given their established settlements, would have been significantly impacted by these reforms that David was about to bring in, especially in the areas of governance and feudalism. The story of Scandinavians in Scotland during the reigns of early kings is one of adaption, resilience, and interplay, from influencing royal ascensions to forging the unique Norse Gaelic culture of the Orkneys. Their mark on Scottish history is undeniable and profound. The tide of time would see the Norse power recede, but their legacy, cultural imprints, and the tales of valour would endure forever in the Scottish tapestry of history. Now, going to a more unique subject, the Norwegian king most relevant to the era of Alexander I and David I was the King Magnus III, also known as Magnus Barefoot or Magnus Barelegs. He ruled from 1093 to 1103 AD. He was a Norwegian king, known for his aggressive foreign policy, which included ventures into the British Isles. His nickname, Barefoot, is believed to have derived from his tendency to wear Gaelic-style clothing, which included kilts that resembled the Scottish and Irish attire. This dressing style stood in contrast to the more traditional Norse tunics. Born around 1073 AD, Magnus was the son of King Olaf of Norway. As a king, Magnus was characterised by his assertive foreign policies and his aspirations to extend Norway's influence, especially across the parts of the British Isles. In this endeavour, his reign marks a kind of reawakening of Norwegian interest in the West, reminiscent of the Viking Age. Magnus's personality was shaped by tales of his ancestors, great Viking explorers such as Ragnar Lothbrok and Ivar the Boneless. This inspired his expeditions and his desire to reassert Norwegian control over the Norse colonies in the British Isles, which had grown somewhat independent over time. His campaigns were not just about conquest, they were about reasserting a historical connection and dominance. However, his aspirations weren't limited to the British Isles. Magnus's ambition also led him to make claims on territories as far away as the Isle of Man and parts of what is now Ireland. He aimed to create a maritime domain linking various North Sea territories, somewhat that would provide both strategic advantage and commercial benefits. One of the most telling anecdotes from his reign is his audacious journey to the Isle of Man. There it's told that he had a ship dragged across a narrow river to claim the land it touched, basing the claim on Norse sagas. Whether or not this tale is entirely true, it demonstrates his larger-than-life persona and his resilience on Norse tradition to justify his territorial ambitions. Magnus's interaction with Scotland, particularly during the reign of Alexander I, was one of assertion and contention. One of the most significant events was the king's campaign in the Isles. Around 1098 AD, Magnus launched a campaign into the Hebrides, an archipelago off the western coast of mainland Scotland as we know. He was responding to a request for assistance from some of the Isles against local rulers, and this gave him a pretext to assert Norwegian authority. Around the same time, the Kingdom of Scotland under the Scottish kings were also seeking to extend its influence in the region. This made a collision with Magnus almost inevitable. However, as we told, direct confrontation was largely avoided. The Treaty of Man around 1098 AD was an agreement, according to some sources, between Magnus and the Scottish king of Alexander's brother Edgar at the time. The treaty essentially allowed Magnus to dominate the Western Isles without much Scottish interference. The reason why Edgar did this was to give Magnus the room to colonise and expand the Hebrides without Scottish interference, because at the time Edgar was trying to consolidate his own land. Thus, while Alexander might have seen the Norse as a potential threat, prior arrangements under his brother Edgar's reign meant that open hostilities with Norway were largely averted. The actual relationship between Alexander I and Magnus would have been one of cautious diplomacy, keeping in mind the treaty's terms. Magnus's life was marked by its bravery. His end came in an expedition in Ireland in 1103 AD. While the exact details are murky, sagas recount that he died in a skirmish in Ulster. His death marked the end of a brief but impactful reign that reshaped the geopolitical landscape of the North Sea region. The subsequent Norwegian kings during David I's reign, like Sigurd I and Harald IV, maintained the Norse presence in the Isles. Still, the dynamic slowly changed as the Kingdom of Scotland became more centralised and assertive under David's strong leadership. And speaking of the man, David I, let's leave this episode here right now, and next week, let's jump into his reign, shall we? Let's finally get it started. Thank you very much for joining me in today's immersive journey into Scandinavian Scotland, however. While we've journeyed extensively through this era today, I must acknowledge that this narrative merely scratches the surface. The depth, intricacy, and the drama of Scandinavian saga in Scotland is such that it could easily occupy its own podcast series. Thus, if at any point you felt that we skated over specific points or missed out certain details, do send me an email or let me know on Facebook or Twitter, but regardless, I do apologise. While our earlier episodes have touched upon the Scandinavian influence in bits and pieces throughout our primary narrative, an exhausted coverage would demand a far broader canvas, perhaps solely dedicated to the interwoven destinies of Scotland and Scandinavia. With that said, I'm brimming with excitement about what's on our horizon. In our upcoming episode, we're going to finally dive into the life, reign, and times of one of the most absolute favourites of mine, David I, King of Scotland. A significant figure in Scottish history, his reign was transformative for the period, and there's a treasure trove of stories for us to finally uncover in many episodes, I think around 4 or 5 we have planned, which I'm sure you're really looking forward to hearing. Now, a quick reminder for all of our avid listeners, our podcast episodes are released weekly, but keep in mind we churn out a maximum of 3 episodes a month. This is to ensure that each episode is well researched, finely tuned, and offers you a rich historical experience. If you're enjoying our series and wish to stay updated, do give us a follow on Twitter at thehistoryofsc1. I repeat, that is thehistoryofsc1. For those more inclined towards Facebook, you can find us there as well at the History of Scotland podcast page. Your engagement, comments and feedback are not just welcome, but deeply appreciated. They provide invaluable insights and motivation for us to keep going. On the note of feedback, if you have a moment to spare, please drop a review on your podcast platform. We're over 120 reviews on Spotify with a 4.8 rating, which is brilliant to see, and we are still somehow the number one Scottish history podcast, which is insane to think about. But yeah, it helps in spreading the word and allows others to join our ever-growing community of history enthusiasts in Scottish history. So yeah, thank you all for the current reviews, and if you could spare the time, if you're new, do drop us a new review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And speaking of which, if you're wondering where you can listen to us, our episodes are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Podbean. So no matter your preference, we've got you covered. That's a wrap for today. Hope this episode added a few more layers to your understanding of Scottish history. As always, thank you for being a part of this enlightening journey. Wishing you a fantastic week ahead. But until next time, have a great week, and I'll catch you all on the next one. Peace.